Welcome back to another episode of First Off, Let's Kill All the Lawyers. I'm David Heffernan. I've been practicing personal injury law here in South Florida for nearly three decades. And the thought behind this show, that quoted Shakespeare line from the 15th century, which drew a lot of chuckles when it was issued, still revs true today. Sometimes you bring it up and people have got their images of lawyers and whatnot. And so goal here is to talk to predominantly, it's been local lawyers. We're going to have a little fun today. We're branching out beyond South Florida, but to bring you a fantastic lawyer, a very good friend of mine, and probably just a better human being, but clearly one we're going to be able to take off the kill list was all when all is said and done. Let me bring in Martin Rubenstein, who is the managing partner of Levy, Baldante, Finney, and Rubenstein in Philadelphia. Marty, good morning.
Great catching up with you, brother. You know that.
It's always fun. So if this is an excuse to catch up, we're going to do it. So let's talk a little bit about first, just out of curiosity, you going to law school. What was behind that? Was this a family thing? Was this something you always wanted to do? What drew you into the law?
So I had always thought about the law. I think that my father, who passed away last year, had a gift of subtly delivering messages to his kids. And he did that with me. So I'll give him a lot of credit for that. And then when I was in high school, I was at best a mediocre student, mainly. I just had interest in other things. I think we all know about that stage of life, you know.
100%.
I was a senior and I had a homeroom teacher, which means that's the person who just makes sure you're showing up.
Right.
And she was truthfully, she was kind of a floozy. Everybody knew it. That's the way she was. And she came up to me one day in class and said, "Hey, guess what? You're on my speech and debate team." I said, "Really? Since when?" She said, "Since right now. I just looked at your grades. You need it." So she immediately, you know, guilted me, intimidated me. And the first thing that she asked me to do was to write a persuasive paper. This is 1974. Okay. And it was about the Arab-Israeli conflict. She gave me a book and this is on the heels of the Six-Day War from the late 60s. She gives me a book and she says, "And by the way, you know, I'm Jewish." She says, "You'll take the Arab side." And, you know,
immediately
jumped back like, "What are you kidding me?" And she said, and her comment was, the other side's too easy. You're going to take the Arab side. So kind of forced me to be an advocate for something maybe I didn't believe in. And I really felt that was like a major moment for me, like going through that. And I stayed with her and I was not a particularly good speaker at that point in my life. And she had me going to these debate and speech tournaments where you'd have to speak for 50 minutes in front of these judges. So it was a wonderful experience, and coupled with my, you know, my father's not so subtle, you know, suggestions to me, that's kind of what led to it. I always wanted, unlike you, Dave, and I know this about you because you and I have done this together for 17 years. You and I always have tried to help those who need it. Usually it's always the individuals. It's the little guys. And taking on the bigger people has always just made it more fun.
100%. And we're gonna weave into that. So you've been doing that, taking on the big guy and representing that individual for close to 40 years in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And nationwide. So let's talk a little bit about your practice, because I'd like to talk today about mass torts. And I know that's been a big emphasis of your practice. It's what actually got you and I connected. And the beauty of that is, you know, you make these relationships through litigation, and then you look at, you know, 17 years or whatever it's been, you know, still very close friends as a result of that. So let's go back a little bit. Mass torts. A lot of people, you know, they think, "Oh, well, it's class action." Well, it's a separate animal. So what is a mass tort?
So basically, there are many situations that occur where there's one particular problem or one particular defect or one particular type of behavior that injures thousands and thousands of people. I mean, just for current examples, a medication or a medical device that was just recalled 2 months ago, made by Philips, called the CPAP machines. Well, they recalled all these machines dating back to 2009, particular models, because they contain a certain plastic that can be carcinogenic. So all these people who've been using it now they're now looking at their medical histories and realizing, well, I have some of that. Is that related? Well, there's thousands and thousands of people who purchased it. So two things will happen. One is many of those people will come and hire you or me or lawyers like us, and we represent those people individually. We are part of a mass tort, meaning there may be hundreds of lawyers around the country who represent these people, but each of these people have an individual lawyer. Class action, which is also taking place with Phillips, is that a group of lawyers will try to take the lead and say, well, there's a lot of issues that will come up in every single one of these cases. We're going to take the lead and file a class action and ask the court to say that we can represent everybody in the country. So there's somewhat of a conflict there. Do these few lawyers get to represent everybody, or do these other guys like Dave Heffernan and Marty Rubenstein get to represent everybody? And as it works out, there's usually a combination. We work together. There's benefits to the class action, and there's the need for people to be represented individually. I tell you that the Supreme Court does not like class action settlements where people have been injured, because they worry that if they approve a class action settlement and people continue to be injured, all the money will be gone, and later victims will never get compensated.
Well, and that's one of the criticisms, I think, that you hear, particularly with class actions, because so many times there's class actions that are really lawyer driven. And at the end of the day, what you see is lawyers making a whole bunch of money, and the relief that goes to the quote unquote victims is a coupon or something here. So, you know, one of the things with mass torts, and you're generally dealing with pretty significant injuries. Okay. And you and I went back and that's how we met. And there's a lot that goes on in Philadelphia, because you got a lot of pharmaceutical companies there. So you gotta reach out and connect with a Philadelphia lawyer, which we did back then. And so let's just kind of talk about how that works from the pharmaceutical end. How would a mass tort start, and how does that work out where, you know, again, lawyers can level the playing field? Because, you know, if one-on-one, if we want to take on, you know, a major pharmaceutical company, it's nearly impossible.
Well, I think you have to start with two pieces. One is the financial, the cost of litigating against pharmaceutical companies. And then second are the resources, the people. So just as an example, the last case that was tried in, I'll say Roundup, the legal cost of trying that case was not in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was over $1 million.
Right.
And as we both know, personal injury litigation, we represent people who've been injured. If it's a serious case, they're not working. They may have no income. They may have no assets. You know, when people are injured, it can be anybody from any walk of life. So lawyers like you and I and our firms, we need to finance those cases. We literally need to underwrite the substantial costs of it. Well, no matter how successful, you know, Heffernan and Karas is, or Levy, Badante, Finney and Rubenstein, we're not going to quite match up with the $1 trillion pharmaceutical company like
not
Johnson.
We're
on our way, but not. It's going to take a while. No. But when hundreds of firms around the country ally together, we share that common expense of putting the case together. And there's two levels to it. One is, you know, when there's a product that's been recalled off the market, we still have to prove what's wrong with that product. The laws in each state are a little different. We have to prove it's defective, either in the way it's made, the way it's designed, or the warnings about it, so that, you know, the doctors can't necessarily prescribe it safely. And then there's, of course, the individuals. Each individual has his or her own story about how they've been injured, what they've gone through, and they need individual attention. So when we combine together, all of a sudden, it's not David and Goliath. You know, it's the pharmaceutical companies would like you to believe that groups like us are bigger than them, which is, of course, hysterical. But it does level it. We certainly have enough resources and talent around the country, and we work together. so that we can put together a very strong case where it needs to be advanced for these people. And we do it all the time.
And that resource, I mean, it's also not just the financial, but again, the resources, because what you're talking about in pharmaceutical litigation is millions upon millions of pages of documents.
Wow.
And so to be able to create depositories, to share paralegals that are reviewing and collating all of that so that it's workable for the lawyers, is critical as well. I mean, firms have to be able to work together to do this.
No question. One of the interesting things for me, and it's kind of a good segue for how you and I met, is that in these mass torts, there may be thousands of claims. I mean, I could rip off some of the drug names and 100,000, 90,000, 20,000, 35,000. Within that, those thousands of claims, vetting it down to figure out, well, whose case really fits what the problem is with this drug. A lot of people may take a drug and have a problem, but it might not be the problem that's really the reason for the recall. It could be something totally unrelated, but most people might not understand that. But once the lawyers get involved in the case, as we have, we have to learn the science. We have to learn what really are the criteria to figure out who is most likely to have proof that they used the medication, that they were injured by that medication in the way that the problem with the medication likely had caused. So if you don't mind, I just wanted to digress, not even to digress, just use this. So, you know, you and I met in the early part of the 2000s, mass tort, right. Was the big pharmaceutical. I'm not going to mention the name because I think our settlement was confidential.
I think so too. So let's not breach anything here.
I'm not in the mood for either of us to get sued right now. So, all right. Dave Wilson, and, you know, trial lawyer from Florida, already was handling a case on behalf of this very compelling woman married to a Vietnam War vet. She was in Missouri in St. Louis. And unfortunately, she had used a cold remedy. And the next morning, that cold remedy, she took it with a Coke. And the combination of that cold remedy that had a stimulant in it, plus the caffeine in her Coke, had an effect that she ended up suffering what's called a hemorrhagic stroke. She had a bleed in her brain, and in her case, caused her to go blind. She was paralyzed on one side of her body, and she suffered some brain injury on top of that. So it was really a horrendous situation. And Dave was representing her. Case was perfectly put together. The manufacturer was a Pennsylvania-based corporation, and another law firm connected, you know, David and I. So that's how we met, you know, two people from different states, never met each other. And then we're all of a sudden intimately involved with this woman and her husband. And we both learned a lot about mass tort in that case, because there were thousands and thousands of those cases. But the case that was perceived to be one of the strongest in the country was the case Dave and I were handling. And it was on a fast track in Philadelphia. So we got that case together. But the big issue was this. This woman used this medication, and our opening that we were preparing forever was she was sitting in a chair by a window that she could never look through because of her blindness. And she was listening to a television show with an advertisement about a law firm that was handling these cases. And she realized the medication she'd taken was upstairs in her bathroom in a pantry. That case is like 16 years ago. It's like it was yesterday. Right. And they produced the evidence to Dave. Dave came up to Philadelphia. We met with defense lawyers from all over the country in litigating the case. Client was terrific. Now it's getting closer and closer to trial. We're negotiating with defense lawyers. And I'd say it was a good relationship. And then as what sometimes happens in litigation, kind of the boom drops. This woman had banked everything on the fact that she had the medication that she had taken. And as it worked out, the medication, when it was tested in terms of the information on the label, that medication was manufactured maybe a year after her injury. So all of a sudden now we have this huge credibility issue. You know, well, if she wasn't telling was she not telling the truth? Was it simply a mistake? And I think because of the way Dave and I had worked together and interacted with the defense lawyers, they really could have taken that case to trial and good opportunity for a defense verdict. But rather than do that, they were smart enough to say, well, our bargaining position just improved, but there's still risk these guys may pull it off. So rather than go to trial with us in Philadelphia, which is a good venue for victims in these cases, they did come back with, under the circumstances, a pretty generous settlement that surprised both of us. And our client was able to move forward. But we learned, again, it was a mass tort. There were class actions filed, but this was going to be a lead case. And Dave and I got a chance to work together. You learn a lot about each other. We learned a lot about similarity in values, what was important to both of us outside the law, certainly the way we talk about our families and relationships, of course, sports. And I've had the privilege of working with you for the past 16 years. So, we're not done. We talked about that also.
That's true. We're not done. And yeah, that was, you go back and you look, and that's truly the sort of the highs and lows of litigation and what you go through. But the byproduct of that is such a nice thing. One, yes, jointly, we got a very nice result, all things considered, for a client who desperately needed help. But two, the relationships, I mean, you get educated on things, and the relationships you create are things that are going to last forever. You know, you've been kind enough, you have Florida cases that come down here, somebody is hurt in an auto accident or anything else that's from Philly, you're kind enough always to reach out to me, and vice versa. We just have more people come from Philly down here than we have going up there. So.
Particularly as I get older, Dave. So
that's it. That's it. Well, we're trying, but, let's shift gears a little bit, only because I know it's something that you've become very actively involved in. We could talk about a lot of things, because I know you did some of the NFL concussion and that's going on, but tragically, and that it's elevated to the level of a mass tort, is the sexual abuse cases, because the curtain's just getting peeled back. And the horrors of what have occurred over so many years are now coming forward. And fortunately, there's lawyers like you that are helping these victims of sexual abuse that may have occurred a long, long time ago, but that impact on these victims certainly doesn't go away. So talk a little bit about how that whole arena of sexual assault has now evolved.
So for me, it kind of started this way. A paralegal came into my office who had a son, 10 years old, shut the door and said, listen, my son's on this soccer team and his coach needs some help. I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, his coach is being accused of sexually abusing another player. So I don't do criminal defense work, but I immediately reached out to somebody I trust up here and got him representation. And then 2 weeks later, that same paralegal walked into my office and said, well, I got some other news. I just learned my son was one of the victims. Mm. So the reason I share that is sexual abuse starts out with people in positions of trust, whether they're teachers, whether they're coaches, whether they're religious. The Catholic Church has come under a lot of fire, but it's not limited to the Catholic Church.
Right.
Every religion has their piece here. And what's really most truthfully disgusting about it is that young people who are in need, frequently people in families maybe that are dysfunctional, a young person who needs somebody to be that mentor, somebody they can trust, is reached out to by somebody who creates that relationship of trust and then exposes the youngster to physical abuse. Certainly the clergy abuse, the stories are just, you can't even really describe them. In fact, when I bring people into the firm to hire them and we kind of indoctrinate them as to what they're going to be talking about, it's just hard to believe. But the bottom line is that this has been going on for, well, some would argue centuries, but certainly 50, 60 years. And when I was asked to get involved, I kind of assumed, maybe a couple dozen cases. There was a big scandal at Penn State involving a defensive coach who had abused some youngsters from a foundation. But this has been an epidemic that's almost at the same level as the pharmaceutical. I mean, one of the cases, the big one right now, is Boy Scouts of America.
Right.
90,000 youngsters through counsel filed claims. Of the 90,000, at least two-thirds have been kind of validated potentially true. It's an over, 60,000 people, kids, how do you even settle cases like that? Those are cases that get settled for billions of dollars. And when it's all said and done, there's still not going to be enough money to really individually compensate these people. So in the sexual abuse arena, we represent hundreds of people in New Jersey who've been abused by different clergy. And in Pennsylvania, in addition to that, we were asked to represent 3,000 individuals who are allegedly physically and sexually abused at a juvenile reform school that was closed. I mean, remember the movie Shawshank Redemption?
Sure.
All right, this was like a juvenile Shawshank Redemption type situation. So we're heavily involved in that. The same issues come up. We represent a lot of people. Look, you and I started, we only represented one person at a time. And we were able to develop relationships with that person that we never forgot, like the pharmaceutical case we discussed.
Right.
With the North Torts, you know everybody, but it's a different relationship. It's just impossible to cultivate with every single person the same, depth of that relationship. And you worry that this becomes a spreadsheet eventually, and that these cases only get resolved in a very cold fashion like that. We do our best to individualize it. We put a lot of time into it. We make sure everybody's story is heard. And one of the most difficult parts, this was learning for me. I've been retained in these cases by a former classmate from my law school class. I thought he was calling me up to refer me at another case. And there's that long pause. And then somebody says, well, the client's me. And then many of these people don't tell you the whole story. In personal injury cases, the problem reportedly is the victims exaggerate their injuries.
Right.
Sex abuse, they don't tell you the whole story. And you have to keep kind of probing until they finally do it. It's like there's this space and it's very sensitive to touch it. We've had people in our office and they, acknowledged what we suspected. We've now done enough of this where we know when somebody's holding out on us. People feel guilt. One of the people I represented, I'm not going to identify the sport, but it is, I'll say it's either the NBA, Major League Baseball, or pro football. It was and was a referee who was on the field during one of these championships. And his family was very active involved in his church, but he wouldn't even tell me his name. It took me 5 months to get his name. He kept calling me because he wanted to share it. And eventually, he kind of mustered up the courage and comfort to do it. So it's really kind of consumed us. It's different than anything we've handled. And but it's got all the features of these other mass torts where the only way to get it resolved is to kind of bundle everybody together. And I kind of shared with you before we got on, I'm involved in a case where the attorney who brought me in, this is the other issue. He is hell-bent on making the biggest recovery in the history of our country for his clients. And I'm not even going to say where this case is. And he's doing a phenomenal job. Some of the lawyering he did is phenomenal. I'm not going to talk about it because some of it's been in the news. But there's an ego issue. And his need to have the greatest settlement in the history of our country, I'm concerned, may jeopardize the rights and best interests of his clients who have, a number of those cases have legal defenses that could result in a dismissal. So we have to always be cognizant of what's in our client's best interest. We want to do our best, as we always do. We did it in another case, and we've done it. You and I have handled a number of cases together. Sure. And I think because of that first case, so, a family member was pretty seriously injured in Florida. I don't think twice. That's a two-second thought. Dave Heffernan, I know you're not only going to be proficient at handling the case, I know that your interests will always be focused on what's best for that client. And that's not a gimme in every situation. So
no, and it is a problem when a lawyer's ego is driving it, and it's no longer in the best interest of the client, because you're jeopardizing a lot of things. And we talk about the sexual assault cases, and again, it's something I think that's just more and more people are starting to come out because they have been quiet for so long, but you're seeing things like women's gymnastic, the U.S. women's gymnastic, you know, being able to testify in Congress. And those are nauseating stories as to how could that have gone on and everybody turned such a blind eye. But you pegged it. And years ago, I had a case with a police officer in Georgia that was a pedophile in a small little town. But yeah, they target. It was young kids with single moms. It was, you know, that didn't have sort of that figure. And they create that persona to put themselves in a position of trust and then abuse it in the worst way possible.
It's horrible. It's just the idea of it is just, you know, anybody who has family or who has friends or who, you know, understands children or, and how it affects these people. I mean, the first gentleman I interviewed was a guy about my age. And I remember sitting across from him and he told me what had occurred. And basically this particular clergy had taken him under his wing and he described his own family situation, which was pretty unfortunate. And he really, really admired this gentleman who, you know, this clergy who had taken him under his wing. And then at some point when he was about 11, and it's graphic, you know, all of a sudden he would touch him kind of outside his clothes and, you know, just comfort him. And then it moved inside under his pants. And then eventually ran to the level of where the clergy masturbated this 11-year-old male, you know, 11-year-old boy. And when this gentleman's now 58 telling me this story, he looked at me and said, you know, one, I trusted him, so I was confused. I mean, he wouldn't be doing anything bad to me. He said, I was 11 years old. I'd never had any type of sexual experience.
Right.
This happens. And it was with a man, you know, with a man. And then he looked at me and said, and I didn't know, you know, was I supposed to enjoy it? And if I do, does that mean that I'm gay? I mean, the confusion from it. Now, this particular gentleman was incredibly level-headed, and I really admired him for his maturity and the way he discussed it with me. But we have situations that was kind of just eye-opening about some of the things, but we have situations involving just Shawshank Redemption type behavior.
Right.
Repeatedly by people in the highest levels of different places, teachers taking advantage of situations, coaches, look, Michigan State, Dr. Nasser. And your question, how could so many people turn a blind eye to it? Well, that was actually what was done for decades. It's not going to happen anymore, but that's what was happening for decades.
Well, and that's certainly one of the reasons that I take great pride. I know you take great pride in representing people like this, because this is how, and you know, we can bash lawyers and first off, we can kill all the lawyers, but the reality is lawyers pushing these issues and bringing them to the forefront and shining light on this darkness is really what does bring about change. And I think we're seeing it radically now in the arena of sexual assault. And Marty, you and I could talk for hours and hours, okay? And we will off of this and catch up again. But certainly, I really appreciate you coming in. We've sort of broadened our reach beyond South Florida now. Now we've got a lawyer in Philadelphia that we can take off the kill list. Marty, it's been great catching up. And again, Marty Rubenstein, managing partner of Levy, Baldante, Finney, and Rubenstein in Philadelphia. Great lawyer, better human being.
I'm proud to be your friend and your colleague. My best to you and whoever's any of your viewers or listeners, and of course, to your family.
Thanks, Marty. Same to you, and we'll talk soon.
Take care.
All right, that wraps this one up. We'll be back next week where another episode of First Off, Let's Kill All the Lawyers.